Advocates are watching closely as Ohio lawmakers debate bills targeting the LGBTQ plus community. After state lawmakers passed several bills aimed at transgender youth in their last legislative session, and as the federal government weighs policies related to health care for trans minors. This is Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss what's being proposed and the impact on individuals and families are Human Rights Campaign Greater Cincinnati Steering Committee Governor Daniel Taylor and Political Action Co-Chair Saul Andrew Kersey, and E, a local parent of a trans child. We're addressing E by her first initial only. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you.
E, can you explain briefly why you want to go only by your first initial, why that level of anonymity is important?
So for us, with the legislation that's come out and the political climate of today, safety is of our utmost concern. And that is part of the reason, but also because my child is not out right now. And so that is his to share with folks and not mine.
Fair enough. Daniel, what are some of the state-level bills the HRC is following, and has there been an increase in this kind of legislation across the country?
Hello, everyone. I am Daniel Taylor, and I use they, them pronouns. I will let Saul and E talk about the specific bills they're concerned with, but just at a high level, talking about that increase, we are seeing a year-over-year increase starting in around the late 2010s, there were maybe around 100 anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislature each year. That broke 200 in 2020 and has risen dramatically every year since then. ACLU has a really great tracker that is tracking more than 400 explicitly anti-LGBTQ plus bills in state legislatures this year alone. And Trans Legislation Tracker, which tracks bills that may have adverse effects against trans and gender nonconforming individuals, is already tracking nearly 700 currently active bills.
Oh, and that's across the country.
Yes.
I know there are a whole lot in Ohio, too. Before we talk about some of those new bills, Saul, I know there is a lawsuit challenging Ohio's ban on gender-affirming care for minors that was passed in 2024. Can you remind us just a little bit about what that ban did and explain where that lawsuit stands right now?
Yeah, so my name is Saul Andrew Kersey. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. And I just want to clarify, Lucy, we're talking about HB 68, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Save Adolescents from Experimentation Act. This bill is essentially masquerading as taking care of and protecting children. And when I say masquerading, it's because the bill goes against every evidence-based standard of care that is not just recognized here in the United States, but is recognized globally in how to care for trans children. And it completely ignores that scientific reality and bans children from receiving medically necessary care to save their lives. In the state of Ohio, there are children who are, and I don't like necessarily using the word grandfathered in, but there are children who are grandfathered in to certain prescription opportunities. But for new care, there's no opportunity in Ohio for children.
And this lawsuit is ongoing to try to...
It is ongoing currently.
Mm-hmm. E, what has that ban meant for you and your family?
Yeah, so that ban really crippled our family. We were patients at Cincinnati Children's, and we were not part of the legacy group of folks because we didn't meet the certain criteria of prescriptions. So we were not allowed to get gender-affirming care here in the state of Ohio. And while I am fortunate enough and privileged enough to be able to travel outside of the state of Ohio, that means that there are lots of folks, trans families here, that are unable to afford this kind of care. And I would just say, too, and I know we're going to touch on it a little bit later, looking at this as it goes out into the wider United States, it's really limiting for us.
Yeah. I do want to talk about some of these other proposed laws that are being talked about in Columbus. What about this Given Name Act in Ohio? Do you mind talking a little bit about that, what it would do, what impact that would have on your family?
Yeah, so the Given Name Act requires schools to let parents to call or to call students by their given name on their birth certificate. This is sort of an extension of the Parents' Bill of Rights Act that already went into place, where schools are required to tell parents if they feel that their students are falling into a gender nonconforming role. This impact for us is not a lot, because we were fortunate enough to be able to change the name on our child's birth certificate. So that would match up.
How difficult is that?
Incredibly difficult. There is a ton of paperwork. There's a fee associated with it. So there's a cost. But then we also can't change the gender marker on our birth certificate where we live. So my child has a name that does not match with a gender on their birth certificate. So this would impact our family in that way.
Saul, what are some of the other proposed bills at the state level? I know there are a lot. We can't talk about all of them, but which ones are you all following most closely?
I think one that we're really trying to focus in and hone in on is this reappearance of bathroom bans that we're seeing pop up across the country. We see this in other states right now a lot, and to the point where, you know, states are beginning to propose offering bounties on finding individuals that are in a restroom that are trans individuals. Yes, that the state would give a cash reward for turning in a trans individual for using the bathroom that matches their gender in public. It's a lot, and that's terrifying, and it creates panic, it creates fear, it creates an untenable environment in which to live.
Is that being discussed in Ohio, or is this in other places?
The bounties are in other places right now, but there is a bathroom ban being discussed in Ohio currently.
Well, we're talking about legislation and policies targeting the LGBTQ plus community. If you have questions or comments, you can give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Saul, another thing I want to ask you about. GLAAD released a report last month that tracked anti-LGBTQ plus incidents in 2025. These were defined as harassment, threats, vandalism, or assaults with anti-LGBTQ hate as a motivating factor. The report found Ohio had the fourth highest number of incidents nationwide. Do you think there's a connection between the legislation that's been adopted, that's now law, the bills that are being proposed? Is there a connection between all of that and these incidents, do you think?
The sociologist in me has to say, well, I need to do some research. But I think it's very clear to those of us in the community that live this experience day to day, that there is an absolute direct, not just correlation, but outright connection between this legislation and what we're seeing day to day and the lived realities that queer people face. The members of the LGBTQ community are in a very difficult situation right now, and difficult is an understatement, but I don't have the time to use every adjective I can think of. It is a situation where I'm going to have to ask you to repeat your question at the end, because I had an answer for you.
Oh, no, that's okay. Whether you think there's a link between these incidents and this legislation.
And there is, based off of our lived experiences. I know E can say this for her family. I know Daniel can say this based off of their experiences. I can say this based off of my experiences, that the legislation is essentially emboldening people to act out on their fear of queer people, to express their homophobia and transphobia in a physical manifestation.
Do any of you feel comfortable talking about those lived experiences? I'm not trying to re-traumatize anybody, but I think it might help people listening understand what those day-to-day realities are. Daniel?
Yeah. So one thing that we see are, for example, large social media accounts that take a lot of comfort knowing that they have these friendly legislation coming. And so for me, one of these accounts did target an acquaintance of mine who is a school teacher. And whenever that happens, we see large numbers of, for example, bomb threats against the schools. Schools have to cancel their classes. People have to, you know, get some sort of enhanced security because they're receiving all of these death threats, all of these bomb threats in schools and hospitals. And, you know, that really disrupts so many more people than just the people who are being targeted, all because there are these friendly laws incoming toward that kind of behavior. So things like the bathroom bans encourage people to try to put out that kind of vigilante justice of their own.
So, I'll say, and this, I would like to provide a content warning for sexual assault for those who are listening right now and joining in our conversation. You know, I am an individual that doesn't believe clothing has gender. They're my clothes. They're not women's clothes or men's clothes. I enjoy wearing a skirt and a dress every now and then. And being chased down the street with the threat of corrective rape in Cincinnati is something that will change your life forever.
That happened to you?
Yes. Oh. More than once. And, you know, I received hate mail in grad school for being the graduate assistant at UC's now closed LGBTQ center. You know, DVD recordings of people telling me, you don't know what kind of trouble you're in and you don't know what you're going to face when you walk out of this building today. And we are seeing this cranked up to even higher levels at this moment in time, at this inflection point in our country's history.
That's got to be terrifying as a mom, E.
Yeah, so we talk often. My child is a preteen, so they do not have social media. They don't have access to all that information. We talk often and openly about what really happens for his safety. But I also would say my husband always says to me, you know, we change people by changing hearts and minds one at a time. And if people were to be able to meet my child and say, oh, I know this kid. This kid is just like Bob or Susie. We would change hearts and minds. Trans and gender nonconforming people are just people. And so I would say too, like us talking very openly about the atrocities that are just happening to our community, I guess helps give my family a little bit more hope in that space. Like, yes, these horrible things are happening and we are building community as we go. And we are going to stand strong together.
Daniel, are there changes at the federal level that have had an impact on how or whether incidents like this are reported or tracked?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of changes in the current administration. So, for example, no federal office is anymore recording data specific to LGBTQ plus people. So they are no longer tracking for specifically anti-LGBTQ plus hate crimes. The census is no longer tracking that sort of data. And so a lot of the data that we have, the numbers are almost certainly worse than what they already seem like because it's based on people like, or groups like HRC, GLAAD, or the ACLU having the time and the resources to locate this information, to assemble it, and to really break it down in ways that can reach all of us. And so some of those changes are all administrative changes. So these are all things that have come through executive orders, whereas the actual law itself is still in place. So things like Title IX, things like the Fair Housing Act, those are still law. Those are still the things that actually govern how our country works. The caveat to that is the law depends on people protecting it, and the law depends on how it's enforced. So they're regularly challenged in court, and right now the federal government is not particularly keen on defending some of those laws. So that is kind of something that could be chipped away at, but is still currently the law.
Saul, I referenced this at the start of our conversation, but there's this proposed federal rule change that would block Medicaid and Medicare funding to any hospital that provides gender-affirming care to minors What are the implications of that locally?
That is really difficult, Lucy, because the implications locally are the stakes are higher than they've ever been. I mean, we have the number one children's hospital in the nation, and that's no joke. The transition clinic at Cincy Children's is quite beyond remarkable. However, we know that major hospitals rely heavily on Medicare and Medicaid funding. That is something that is required for them to operate. And I believe that we are going to see major healthcare providers in this area have to make very, very, very difficult decisions soon. My one hope, I would say, is that we don't see pre-compliance with this, that we actually wait until these rules go through the regulatory process and become part of the Code of Federal Regulations. That's one thing that does give me hope in this moment, is that if we're rewriting regulations, there's a regulatory scheme and process that does take time, that does require citizen input, and will hopefully be able to not, I don't know if we would be able to eradicate something as awful and horrendous as this, but that we would be able to dull the sharp edge that's coming toward our community.
And E, your family has already had to make changes in terms of where your child gets care, right?
We sure have. We had to leave Cincinnati Children's, and we went to University of Michigan, and they pre-complied as well. So we lost medical care there as well. We have not selected another location yet because now we're considering what does overseas care look like based on the national potential to have gender-affirming care nationally banned.
Wow. Daniel, earlier this month, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons issued a recommendation against gender transition surgery for young people under the age of 19. You're not a medical professional, I know, but do you know how common that type of surgery is for minors? There's been a lot of discussion about it in recent years.
Yeah, so even in the statement that they issued, they already indicated this is not a common practice. So one thing that I think is really important is when we talk about gender-affirming care, particularly for minors, it's often couched in sort of very visceral terminology that is meant to evoke a really negative reaction from people. And I think it's really important just to take a minute or two to really talk about what gender-affirming care for minors actually looks like. Because if people have the facts about what this care looks like, it's not a scary thing. It's a thing that is already in practice for a number of other medical conditions. It's a practice that is, in many cases, reversible. So there are things that are not really a danger. So for example, before puberty, transition is primarily just a social aspect. So things like allowing a child to explore their gender identity through a name or pronouns, using new clothes, new hairstyles, these are all things that any child would do. They're just demonized when the child is expressing a different gender identity. Comparatively, during or after puberty, this can include medication, so things like puberty blockers. They delay the effects of puberty, which allow a child to really figure out their gender before experiencing a lot of the side effects of puberty that can make gender dysphoria significantly worse. These are things that are in use for over 30 years. They have been used for things like precocious puberty for children who go through puberty at an extremely young age. And they are in effect while you're taking them. And then once you stop taking them, you just go through your regular processes again with your body. And then after that point, we may introduce things like hormone replacement therapy. So medication like testosterone or estrogen, which are completely natural hormones. You and I both have them in our bodies in different levels. And they are things that, for example, testosterone is about to celebrate its 100th birthday as a unique drug that has been separated. And they're used for different purposes in both cisgender and transgender people. And for folks who don't know, cisgender is simply the term for people whose gender identity conforms with the body that they were born in. So things like testosterone can be used to treat sexual dysfunction, estriol to treat symptoms of menopause. These are completely safe, normal medications.
And again, I just want to underscore, I know you're not a doctor, but this is what you've researched, what HRC has been following. Did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, if I may, and I'm not trying to take away from Daniel, but I want to also emphasize that WPATH, which is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, released their Standards of Care 8 recently, and that is the global standard of what transgender healthcare looks like at every age. They specifically don't recommend surgery for children because global medical experts overwhelmingly support access to age-appropriate and individualized care. That's the key we're looking for here, is this individualized care. We're not rushing to provide, you know, gender confirmation surgeries for children. We're not. That's not appropriate.
You can't reverse those things.
We want to give children the opportunity to develop and learn who they are on their own, who they are at a core level.
And in the particularly rare instances where that is recommended, it's based on discussion between a child, their family, their medical provider, a number of different, you know, groups within that medical provider service. So it's not something that is just done regularly. It's done based on an individual need that is decided by a trained medical professional.
Yeah. We've been talking about a lot of really heavy subjects. Has the Human Rights Campaign seen anything positive come out of these changes across the country, Daniel?
Yeah, so what we've seen, especially in some very high-profile elections recently, is that attacks on trans individuals are not necessarily translating into a winning political strategy. In the Virginia governor's race, Abigail Spanberger's opponent spent reportedly $7 to $9 million attacking her explicitly for her support of transgender individuals, and she won a very decisive victory. In New York City mayor's race, Soren Mamdani won a very good win after embracing the trans community, talking about some very robust plans for supporting trans healthcare. So I'm very hopeful that as this continues, we may see that also play out in Ohio. Time will tell. But, you know, politicians sticking to their values and supporting the needs of some of their most vulnerable constituents is a winning strategy.
Yeah. E. Daniel just used that word, hopeful. Where do you find hope in this as a mom with a kiddo, as you said, who's going to be dealing with all this, dealing with all this?
I find hope in community. I am super thrilled to know these folks from HRC. And, you know, one of the things that is upcoming is our dinner, and that's on Saturday. And it is just such a community-filled, loving, joy-filled event. And that is an annual event that just sparks my heart.
And we have information about that dinner on our website, wvxu.org. I have been talking with Human Rights Campaign Greater Cincinnati Steering Committee Governor Daniel Taylor and Political Action Co-Chair Saul Andrew Kersey, and E., a local parent of a trans child. We've been addressing E. by her first initial only. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Up next, an effort to make same-sex marriage part of Ohio's Constitution. This is Cincinnati Edition.